proceed to the second case of the day, Vonderweer v. MTEC International.
I just press this little button.
Ms. Belk?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court? Belinda Belk and John Bush on behalf of SEPTEC Appellant and Cross Appellee Mr. Vonder. As you are aware, there are two appeals in this case today. I will first be addressing SEPTEC's appeal, and Mr. Bush will address the response to the cross-appeal in the 10 minutes we've allowed for response rebuttal. Going to SEPTEC's appeal, the district court improperly struck the testimony of Mr. Vonder and SEPTEC's lost profits damage calculation. Now, SEPTEC's lost profits damage calculation was based on evidence supporting its reasonable certainty, and the Illinois new business rule does not take that away. In addition, Mr. Vonder's testimony is proper lay witness testimony under Rule 701. He should have been allowed to testify as to his particularized and special knowledge in this case.
He had no special knowledge about marketing this drug because it didn't even have FDA approval, much less any marketing experience.
Well, in this case, what Mr. Vonder, it's his particularized knowledge here in relation to...
I'm saying he doesn't have any knowledge, general or particularized, because, first of all, he hadn't been in pharmaceutical products. He hadn't been in that business. He'd been in the medical devices business. And secondly, the chain of ifs that he wanted to testify to that would have led at the end to an actual functioning business was so long that it seems to me the district court was well within its discretion to say this really can't come in under 701.
Well,
and you never try to qualify him under 702.
That is correct, Your Honor. But here, what Mr. Vonder's business is that he is a founder of MTEC. Not only is he a founder of the company, he found Dr. Potempa and the sepsis technology. He worked with them. He has that knowledge about what it can do. And he also...
He hopes it can do, but it's not the same, presumably, as Zygris, or he wouldn't be able to get a patent on it. It's not in the market right now. Anyone who's been through FDA approval processes knows that these can take quite a long time. Phase 3 studies are expensive. Phase 1 and Phase 2 studies, for that matter, have to have. It's just there's no direct personal experience. It's not like the businessman who wants to come in and say, I've been selling cars for the last 30 years of my life, and here's how I think I would be selling cars.
Well, what Mr. Vonder has done in his business life, from MTEC to Criticare to SEPTEC, is that he's taken these technologies. And I would like to point out that the point that it's a pharmaceutical versus a medical device here doesn't change the business model. These medical devices also had to go through FDA approval and regulatory systems. What Mr. Vonder, his particular...
It's a different process. You would have to agree with that.
It is a different process. But what his model is that he works with a corporate partner who shoulders the regulatory burden, who he gets the technology, and he knows what it can do. He's got reports as a founding shareholder and director of the corporation, what it can do. He's worked with Dr. Potempa to see what it can do.
He has hopes as to what it may do, but as I understand his expected testimony, he wanted to testify that he thought it was going to be a safe and effective treatment for sepsis. All right. Well, the FDA hasn't proven, nothing. That's just his, I would say, you know, you would need an expert, physician, scientist, you know, somebody to say that. He thinks that the FDA would have approved it. Maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't. That looks speculative to me. He thinks that SEPTEC would have found a corporate partner to agree to develop and market. We don't know who, we don't know when, we don't know what terms. He thinks there would have been a 5% cut of the profits. He thinks it would have gotten 50. I mean, this is all, sure it looks good as a business goal, but I just don't see where it comes in under 701.
Well, I think that where the evidence does show the safety and efficacy is proved by admissions of MTEC through Dr. Potempa and their own documents that say it's been safely injected into humans, it's been effective to treat sepsis.
Safety is different from effectiveness. And weren't there a couple of baboons that, you know, it was effective in?
The patent itself says that sepsis, this MCRP, has been proven effective to treat sepsis. That says that in the patent, straightforward.
And so that's called a patent claim. You know, it's not the same as FDA approval.
And then also, what the FDA looks at is, and what you look at when you're looking at a new product, is what has it been proven thus far? Is it safe and effective? They've injected into humans many times, which the MTEC, again, in Record Site 72, Exhibit 18, they admit that it's been safe and effective to inject into humans. And even if it is baboons, it's the closest, it's often used by scientists to test such a product. In this case, the admissions by MTEC prove that it was safe and effective. And Mr. Vonder's business was to get these new technologies and to profit off them by working with a corporate partner. The Dade Behring Agreement is an example of such a corporate partner and such an arrangement. And I will let Mr. Bush handle the rest of the argument. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Quinn.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Jonathan Quinn, and I represent the appellee, ImTeC Pharmaceuticals, and cross-appellants T. Stephen Thompson, Gary Parks, and Eric Sorkin. Our cross-appeal raises the issue of whether the individual defendant's actions are protected by the long-standing privilege that protects a corporation's officers and directors from personal liability for tortious interference when their corporation breaches a contract.
And actually, could we just sharpen that question? Because what your cross-appeal really does is it asks the question whether any rational jury could find that this standard had been met, an abuse of the privilege under all the evidence, if you will. And so it's not the, you know, what do we think, what do I think, what do you think. It's really, could anyone find this? And there, I would invite you to focus for a minute on the fact that the stock option agreement, as I understand it, although you can correct me if this is wrong, says that it can be exercised in whole or in part. That's my first point of concern, and they don't let him do that. And secondly, as I understand this record, when he tenders the check that's $24 or so short, he says, you know, I'll be glad to pay more, but they didn't give him any opportunity to pay that other $24. It strikes me, I guess, in short, that there's evidence in this record from which a rational jury could conclude that there was the type of abuse that's prohibited.
Your Honor, certainly your recitation of the standard of review is correct. It is a rational jury standard. However, few things need to be noted. Number one, with regard to the privilege that the corporation's officers and directors enjoy, it is the burden of the cross appellees to overcome that privilege, and we maintain that there was no evidence from which a rational juror could have concluded that the cross appellee did in fact sustain their burden. Specific to your points.
Okay.
With regard to the terms of the stock option agreement itself, while it did contain the language you speak of, the price term what was crystal clear. It contained a specific price which because of the way in which the stock had split over the years had become, by cross appellee's own acknowledgement, a confused issue.
I understand that we get these three different prices, but what I don't understand is that the check he mails for $8,292.60 is big enough to cover a lot of shares, maybe not all 24,390 if the price term over the years has changed. It's not 34 cents, it's 0.3409594. But why isn't that regarded as simply an exercise in part, since that's what, or you know, alternatively, why not say, you know, we understand you're trying to buy the 24,390, you owe us another 24, he sends it to you and we're not here.
Your Honor, it is important to understand that in addressing what it is the individual the defendants did in response to that letter, the legal framework under which that analysis must take place is to ask whether the actions of the individual defendants were either taken to advance their own personal goals or to solely to injure the other party to the contract.
Right,
without...
and it's the second part that I think is really at issue here. I don't think anybody's focusing on their personal interest, but if they're willing even to bring the corporation into a breach of contract, which looks like a needless breach, I don't see an efficient breach story here, a jury could think that you're doing that for vindictive reasons. And if they're willing to... take all of these steps to make it impossible for him to do something as simple as exercise an option, I mean, that really shouldn't be all that crazy.
Your Honor, the evidence...
Why couldn't the jury say this was done for vindictive reasons?
Because there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that it was.
There is. I mean, they go to their lawyer, but surely you're not saying that talking to a lawyer in a tiny little company like this is a silver bullet that means all of a sudden, I mean, everybody would go to have a chat with a lawyer for that. There wouldn't be liability ever.
No, Your Honor, of course not. But the evidence that came in, the evidence that is uncontroverted, establishes the following, that several days after Mr. Vonderer sends his letter, which by all acknowledgments contains a confusion about which portion of the stock option he was seeking to exercise, a few days later, he filed a lawsuit in the state of Wisconsin against not only IMTEC, but against the individuals personally for breaches of their fiduciary duty. In that same intervening time, the people whom you're contending were motivated to cause Mr. Vonderer malice.
I'm just saying, a jury could think, whether I think it or not, not being the question.
Your Honor, during that same period of time, the individuals took specific and affirmative action to make certain that the options that his lawsuit in Wisconsin complained he had not received, in fact, had been sent a year earlier, and to correct any possibility that that hadn't been done, they resent him another certificate for those same stock. So the evidence that came in at trial was that the individuals were not only not acting with any ill will or malice, they were taking affirmative action to make certain that that to which he was entitled, he got.
Well, and that's the earlier one, but why, for example, does Parks wrote hold per TST and Sorkin on the letter, that what he was going to send as a response to the April 30 letter, for instance?
Because, Your Honor, because the lawsuit in Wisconsin had been filed.
On a different set of options, though.
On a different set of, yes, of course, on a different set of options, but alleging breaches of fiduciary obligation stemming from the same course of conduct, and about which, whether it was wrong or right, about which the individual certainly had a privileged business judgment to consult the corporation's lawyer about. Following that legal advice, Your Honor, the corporation, and indeed the individuals, sent a letter to Mr. Vonderer, and let me correct one thing you said earlier. It is not true that Mr. Vonderer communicated verbally or in writing that he would accept some smaller portion of anything. There was no such communication. And, importantly, when the corporation finally responded in writing to the April 26 letter, they returned his check. They told him it was for the incorrect amount, but they never, either then or at any point along the way, ever told him that they deemed his exercise to be too late, would not honor it. And, in fact, the testimony at trial from Mr. Sorkin was that from that point forward throughout the trial, the corporation's books reflected that those stock options were open, and had Mr. Vonderer at any point had sought to send either a different amount or had clarified that he wanted a lesser amount, the company would have honored that request. They did not ever slam...
Did the jury have to believe that, though? I mean, I'm sure that was your argument, but he would have been presenting to the jury the fact that they really shut down communications, they return the full check, they don't say, you owe us another $23.40 or whatever it was. I mean, did the jury have to accept the explanation that you've just offered?
The jury would have to be able to point to some piece of actual evidence that suggested that the reason why the individual defendants did not give Mr. Vonderer what he wanted when he wanted it was either because they were trying to advance their own self-interest or because taking off their corporate representative hats, and this is very important, the actions the individuals took, they were not taking outside the scope of their duties as officers and directors. They were not acting in an effort to injure him for any personal reasons. The actions they were taken, and they were taken with the consultation of the corporation's lawyers, was to hold Mr. Vonderer to what the express terms of an admittedly confusing contract was.
But why couldn't the jury have also taken into account some of the history of these various corporations? I mean, Mr. Vonderer was not a total stranger to MTEC, of course. He had been, didn't he actually even start it? But anyway, he resigns in March of 99 from that. These people may, the jury may have thought, they may well have been bearing grudges against each other, and the people left in MTEC may have been indeed taking off their hats as MTEC officers and just making life difficult for Mr. Vonderer.
Your Honor, it's quite clear that the jury did one or more of the things you're suggesting. The question for this court is whether it ought to allow that jury verdict to stand in light of the complete absence of any evidence. The other prong of the test about
but
which...
But there was evidence about the prior relationship, wasn't there, and when he resigned from MTEC?
Yes, but that there is no evidence linking any of that to the actions taken in respect of the breach of stock option agreement that underlies this tortious interference claim. Much, if not most, of that conduct to which you refer has to do with a separate contract that the jury separately found that the corporation did not breach, let alone tortiously interfere with. So with regard to evidence that was relevant to the issue of this contract, there was none. Secondly, with regard to a second prong of the test, regardless of whether or not there was evidence of an intent to injure, there is no evidence whatsoever, even if the individual defendants did that, that their actions were contrary to the best interest of the corporation. A complete lack of evidence about that, and no...
So is that an efficient breach argument? I'm not sure why you say that if we assume that there's a breach of the option agreement. I mean, to drag a corporation into litigation and to breach a contract without costing out, in a sense, what it will cost to breach versus what it will cost to perform strikes me as wasting the corporation's assets, not something in its best interest.
And, Your Honor, I won't necessarily disagree, but the issue here is whether or not that constitutes something for which this court ought to permit someone to sue and obtain personal liability against the individuals who, all the evidence demonstrates, were acting in what they believed to be the best interest of the corporation and without any intent to injure. To allow this verdict to stand and to not reverse the lower court's decision to deny our motion for judgment of law would be to allow corporations, officers, and directors to be sued and to be personally liable for a whole range of things that, when all is said and done, constitute a breach of contract, but nothing more. The jury decided that the corporation had breached the contract here, and we do not raise that. We do not contest that. But it's quite another thing to then go from that and to show that three individuals who were at all times acting with consultation with lawyers, and I do want to point out the IOS Capital case, which is very much on point here, even if their conclusion ultimately is one with which we would not agree and with which the jury didn't agree, it is not appropriate to defer to the jury's verdict in a situation like this in which there is absolutely no evidence. Putting aside inferences that people may draw, there's a difference between the inferences that a jury may draw and actual evidence that a judge should consider.
I don't understand that at all. Juries draw inferences all the time from facts.
Well, Your Honor, you alluded to a course of conduct over the course of years that I said to you was had to do with a separate contract in which even the cross appellee didn't argue, mm-hmm. although actually I take it back at times they did. The issue, however, though, is not whether a jury may infer from anything under the sun that something took place. That a jury may make reasonable inferences under certain situations that are determined by the law. And you are correct. It is obvious that the jury did one or more of the things you are saying. But that is the appropriate province. That's exactly why there is such a thing as a motion for a judgment as a matter of law. That's why we brought it. That's why we contend that the court should have granted it, and that's why we think it would be appropriate for this court to reverse the lower court's decision in a situation like this, where allowing the verdict to stand would chill corporate officials from performing their duties and would be contrary to the whole concept of limited liability, which is accorded in corporation. Your Honor, before I sit down, let me just also very briefly address the main appeal. We believe, Your Honor, that for all the reasons contained in the 7 briefs that were filed in support and in opposition to the motions in limine, and if this court reviews nothing further but the transcript of the evidentiary hearing that the lower court held, which is record number 87, to contend that the lower court abused its discretion, let alone made an error, would be contrary to both the facts and the law. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Quinn. Mr. Bush?
May it please the Court, John Bush for Gerhard Vonderer. I'd like to first address very quickly the concept that the conduct of the defendants was in the best interest of the corporation, or the proof with regard to that. I first state to the Court that it's, as a matter of just simple logic, how can it be in the best interest of the corporation generally to act against the interests of its shareholders? This is the holding of the Easness Theaters case, but more than that, as a matter of fact, at record site supplemental appendix 1513, I specifically asked Mr. Thompson and I specifically asked Mr. Parks if they knew what their duties were as officers of directors. They said yes. As a matter of fact, I said, question, and one of these duties, you recognize one of them is just fairness, correct? The answer was correct. And fairness has an aspect of candor to it, correct? And the answer is correct. So and I argued that to the jury, there simply wasn't any question that to act in the disinterests, which was found to be, as a matter, they're not even appealing the fact that there was a breach, and they were acting in the disinterest of the shareholders. Let's talk a minute about...
One could imagine that they didn't know at the time that there was going to be a finding of breach. Mr. Vonderer is off there suing them, perhaps on a different option agreement. Most corporations and officers of corporations begin to proceed cautiously once they're in a litigation posture with somebody else, and they do proceed cautiously. They contact, they talk to each other, they contact the lawyer. Why do we jump from that to some inference that this is all done out of pure vindictiveness against Mr. Vonderer?
Well, let's talk first about the lawyer. To a certain extent, isn't that really the devil made me do it? I don't mean to interrupt. You can look at the summary judgment. You can look at everything. This was a latter day. This was at the very end, this idea of consultation of lawyers that came up, number one. Number two, even though it may be a statement of law, it is in first and foremost an issue of fact as to whether or not they ever consulted an attorney. I other than the testimony of these individuals, which was found obviously to be incredible by the jury, there isn't one piece of evidence that indicates that their actions were spurred whatsoever by consultation with an attorney. As a matter of fact, as the court pointed out, everything, and I'll show in a moment, everything was hold per HST. Everything was, I'm sending this to you, Mr. Sorkin. What is the name of this lawyer? Where was this lawyer in the courtroom? Where is this lawyer on their witness list? Because you know what? I would have liked to have been able to ask them what kind of lawyer, in light of the law of the state of Illinois, which talks about substantial performance, would advise a corporation that they should breach an agreement for a lousy $23.40. Because you know what? The jury could have said they never consulted that lawyer, or even more importantly, they could have said they consulted that lawyer and they told this man's clients that if they did that, they were crazy, and the advice was, don't do it. That was an inference that equally could have been made from the from these facts. Just because it's said by 3 individuals who the jury found to be incredible doesn't mean it's true. And as context, I'll show you some more facts. This runs not only to that issue, but runs to the issue of malice. Interestingly enough, they didn't even appeal the finding, the direct factual finding of malice. What underpins that and what underpins the fact that they meant to injure Gerhard Vonderer? We start in 1999. This is trial exhibit number 83. Contrary to what Mr. Quinn said, this letter specifically from Mr. Sorkin, as early as 2 years before the relevant event, demands, quote, "We are demanding IMTEC to rescind all of Mr. Vonderer's options and warrants for cause." As early as 2 years earlier, that's what Sorkin's mindset was. We skipped to 1 year, 1 year previously, 1 year after that, and 1 year before the exercise of the option. Mr. Gerhard Vonderer exercises an option for 11,716 shares, never gets the certificate. They
now,
say,
isn't that the one, though, that eventually, I mean, they're trying to fix it and there's the litigation?
It took a point of a lawsuit after, in the record, you'll see there were also letters to him saying, I need some help because I'm getting a 1099 from you people that I'm going to have to pay taxes on $270,000 worth of realized gain, and I don't even have the stock certificate. It took a lawsuit to have them spurred into action. As to,
I mean, their story, of course, is that there was just some administrative glitch, and for some reason he didn't get it.
That clearly was not believed by the jury. The fact of the matter is that when it comes to this particular exercise, the 34 cents, where does that come from? Well, the testimony is Mr. Vonderer, and it's at the record 1221, transcript 249, on cross by Mr. Quinn. He gets a call. Mr. Vonderer gets a call from his good friend, Mr. Anderson, who says, don't forget to exercise your 34-cent option, because Mr. Anderson, Dr. Anderson, had exercised the very same options for 34 cents, not 34.115, not pi or whatever the number they came up with, but 34 cents. Mr. Vonderer, April 26, 2001, sends his check for 24,390 options for $292.60. He not only knows his 34 cents from talking to Dr. Anderson, he has the filing that he has underlined, and this was plaintiff's trial exhibit number 10, a filing from IMTEC alone, specifically saying the option price was 34 cents. In addition to that, 2 years previously, February 25th, 1999, Mr. Parks, one of the defendants, sends a letter to Gerhard Vonderer, trial exhibit 76, saying the option price is 34 cents. A memorandum is done, October 20th, 2000, because there are disputes between Mr. Vonderer and IMTEC, and at the last page, appellate 787, from their own lawyers. Are these the lawyers they consulted? We don't know. But their own lawyers, Messrs. Keating and Walsh, says the exercise price due May 1st, 2001, 34 cents.
So maybe it would be helpful if you looked at each defendant. I mean, clearly this privilege applies. It's a personal privilege. Each defendant has this privilege. I have the sense that you're kind of lumping them together. And so we need to find, you know, see where is there evidence from which a rational jury could find that each one of them isn't simply operating for the corporation as he ought to, but is in fact doing something malicious toward Mr. Vonderer.
Plaintiff's trial exhibit number 83 for Mr. Sorkin. We hereby demand that you rescind all of Mr. Vonderer's options and warrants.
So that's
for
Sorkin. Okay, number one.
Memo. From Mr. Parks, who first of all, he writes a letter. Excuse me. Trial exhibit number 99, where on May 4th, 2001, the corporation, as the secretary, Mr. Parks, writes a letter to the transfer agent saying, please process these 24,399.
Right, this is the letter that he
doesn't
send out. Right,
and it says, hold per TST, Thomas T. Stephen Thompson.
Thompson and Sorkin. So why does that make Parks culpable? Parks is doing what somebody else tells him to do.
I would say that at the end, Parks writes a letter on January 26th. 2001, where it says, quote, as you know, you have been, with respect to your letter requesting 24,000, your letter fails to identify exactly which options you're intending to exercise. I asked him about that. He said he knew, and he admitted to the court and to the jury, he knew exactly what they were talking about. Indeed, the evidence shows that they were. I said, were you not acting disingenuously? And the one thing the three of you, with all due respect, can't fully appreciate is how these three gentlemen, in response to questions from a rube from Wisconsin, like myself, squirmed and were looked like the liars and schoolboy liars they were. And that's just the fact, Judge. And that's why the judge spanked them. That's why the jury spanked them. And there was plenty of evidence for doing it. And it's not as if they fell in love with me because they didn't give me my my award on the first cause of action. It was just, it was the fact.
Start hiring rubes.
Well, I think 1976, Your Honor.
I don't think that's a profile of the firm. But
well, that's why I barely made it where I am. The fact of the matter is there is ample evidence up and down, and on this particular claim in, where they don't even attempt to appeal the underlying breach of the contract, that these gentlemen
acted. Well, I mean, but that makes sense. I mean, it's one thing, as they pointed out, to hold that a corporation has breached a contract. It's another thing to go after the officers and the like.
And I don't do that. That's not done lightly. And it was subject to a summary judgment motion, and the evidence that I'm putting before this court or talking about this court is the same evidence that I gave to Judge Gettleman. He weighed it. He allowed it to go to the jury. He saw the credibility issues. I will not use the L word. He saw the credibility problems that these three gentlemen had in responding to my simple questions. I believe that if you look at the evidence, if I just marshaled it, it presents a compelling argument that they were not acting in the best interest of the corporation, but in the interests.
Did no discovery produced the name of the lawyer?
None.
And that was sought by...
That didn't even come up until trial. That did not come up until trial. There, you look at the some
trial depositions.
There wasn't anything. There wasn't no Rule 26 discovery. Nothing. Who is this lawyer?
A rube from Wisconsin.
Could be. Even a rube would have gotten it right, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.